So welcome everyone. This is the May 24th edition of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace at the University of Arkansas teleconference series. I'm Tom Anderson and I'm the host every month. And each month we have conversations with leaders from the intersection of the worlds of faith and spirituality, business, and academia. And the ongoing question and the theme for the teleconference series is this: what can leaders and organizations learn from the faith and spiritual traditions that will help them to make a more positive difference in the lives of all stakeholders? Today, we're speaking with someone who has been around this work for many years. We were talking about it just a little bit before we started the conference today. Our guest is Patricia Aberdeen. Welcome, Patricia. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure to be with you, Tom.
I'll tell you a little bit about Patricia for those that might not know her or her work. Patricia is one of the world's leading social forecasters. For 25 years, she has been tracking how change impacts business. Through her books, her talks, and her workshops, Patricia has helped thousands of organizations and millions of people make the most of social change and transformation. She's the co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Megatrends 2000, and also the author of the book that we'll be spending most of our time talking about today, Megatrends 2010, The Rise of Conscious Capitalism. So, Patricia, I just want to tell you how good it is to connect with you and have you joining us here today. Thanks a lot for taking your time to do so.
Pleasure is mine.
We're going to start today, as we always do on these teleconferences, with a short reading from Patricia's book today. And then we're going to take just a couple of minutes in the silence, during which I will just invite you to turn to source as you best understand and interpret source, and just take a few minutes in the shared silence together. So first, this is a paragraph from page 45 of Megatrends 2010. And I think it kind of sums up the overall theme of what we're going to be talking about today in the book itself. And here's what it says. Conscious capitalism means we are becoming aware of the unbearable price of an unconscious, not to mention illogical, philosophy that would embrace, quote, profit at any cost, end quote. The spiritual dimension of conscious capitalism tells us that the answers to issues as ordinary as business problems and as extraordinary as planetary survival lie in the divine realm of consciousness, and that spiritual practice is the most efficient way to attain the frequencies where practical wisdom resides. And so with that, I just invite you to take a moment in shared silence. Thank you. Well, Patricia, I have to tell you a little bit and kind of share with the audience what was one of the things that led me to invite you to be a part of this conversation. And it happened about a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. And I was going through the old archives of recordings. We were talking before the conference started about the International Center for Spirit at Work and Judy Neal's work there, and the series that this is a continuation of that she really started at that organization. And there was a recording of an interview she did with you, and it must have been done at about the time Megatrends 2010 was either getting ready to be published or had just come out, maybe back in 05, 06, somewhere along there. And you were having a conversation about what these megatrends for 2010, and you were 4 or 5 years or 6 years from the date. And I was listening to this in early 2011, and I thought, well, this might be fun. Now that we've gone past Megatrends 2010, or gone past the year 2010, rather, to kind of take a look back and talk about this book, talk about the what was obviously pretty groundbreaking work at the time, from the perspective of hindsight, see where we are, and then maybe look forward a little bit and see where we may be going next, to see what perhaps might be on the horizon for Megatrends 2015 or 2020. So one thing I wanted to start with is just what kind of led you to write this book back in 03, 04, 05, when you were putting this together? What was it that originally led you to look at this, and what do you really mean by a megatrend anyway?
Oh, well, that's two or three questions right there.
Okay.
let's start with your first question, and then we'll talk about what a megatrend is, because what got me to write the book was my own personal journey. Now, I think the best books come somehow out of not just the head, but the heart. But I had been a very successful trend writer for many years. I had had a very fulfilling life in that regard. And at a certain point in my life, I don't know, I guess I was about 45 or so, many changes started to happen. My co-author and I split up, and very caringly and lovingly, and went our separate directions. And my spirituality went from being an interest, an avid interest, if you will, to really the center of my life. And so I took a long sabbatical and devoted many years. I'm trying to guess how many. Between 7 and 10 years of my life. Oh, now I'm showing my age, but that's okay. I have a feeling that might be among friends. But, 7, 10 years, something like that, to my spiritual path. But at some point along the way, this desire emerged within me to try to fuse them together, to try to fuse my own now much richer spiritual life with my, trend forecasting and trend reporting of the past. And I wrote a book I thought was going to do something like that. And it just went nowhere. It just was absolutely going nowhere. And I was at a conference. I met a wonderful woman who was a great activist, Barbara Waugh, who was a great activist at Hewlett Packard. And I was speaking, and I was talking about what I saw, I wasn't using the term trends. I was saying, I think this is happening, I think that's happening. And Barbara came up to me after that speech, and she said, I got to tell you something. You're going to really hate me for saying this. You're going to hate my whole message, but here goes. You should take that whole, all that stuff you're talking about, rewrite it as take these spiritual developments and rewrite them, recast them as megatrends. And then you're going to really have something important. And I thought, she doesn't know what she's talking about. What is she telling me this stuff for? I'm never going to do that. So, of course, I was in a little bit of resistance there. But nevertheless, the days went by, the weeks went by, and I just couldn't get her message out of my mind. So one day, I did one of my most favorite things to do, which is I opened my journal to a big, clean page of paper, take out my colored pens. For some reason, I feel freer when I write with colored pens. And I said, well, I still don't think what Barbara knows what she's talking about. But if she did, let's just say she has a good idea here. What would those megatrends be? Well, I started knocking off trends, not megatrends, but trends. I said, oh, well, that might be one. Well, that might be one. Well, that might be one. Pretty soon I had 3 or 4 of them, and I said, might as well keep going. And came up with the first draft of the table of contents of this book. And then as I worked with these trends, I said, well, these are trends. They're great trends. But the mega trend is conscious capitalism. The mega trend is how human consciousness, including spirituality, is transforming business. That's the mega trend. And there are so many facets in this jewel of the transformation of business. And, a lot of folks maybe aren't comfortable with the spiritual component. And so they think in terms of social responsibility. And that's certainly an important facet of the whole thing. But for me, it's got to have the spiritual part. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to write the book. And I wrote that book in 1 year. I mean, so that's pretty fast by my standards. I've spent a lot longer than that. But it was like, you know, all the pieces came together. And in a year, I wrote the book and found an agent, found a publisher, and was published in 2005.
And it all started with something you didn't feel comfortable or particularly happy with doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Isn't that a lesson that for all of us?
I'm willing. Oh, and
I was more than uncomfortable. Yeah. I was just downright resistant.
I'm willing to bet there's more than a few people on this call that see some of their own path and their own process in that story. So, thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Sure.
So when you're talking about conscious capitalism. And yeah, I think you started to touch into your definition of it there at the end of what you were saying. But what else would you like to say about that? What when you're using that term, and even that term, that term itself has come to mean even more over the past 5 or 6 years. It seems
that's kind of escaping me. It has a life of its own.
Yeah. So when you were talking about conscious capitalism, was that term even back in 03, 04, 04, when you were writing the book, 05, was it in common usage? Were you kind of...
No, it certainly wasn't in common usage.
Yeah.
I don't claim to have coined it, in part because, you know, mostly because I think that these notions get downloaded into people, and a lot of people get them at the same time. Mm-hmm. I later heard that one of the first people to use the term was Mohammed Yunus, of Grameen Bank fame. But I had never heard the term before. So, in my own head, I had kind of coined it, but regardless of who coined it, it's gaining some traction now.
Yeah. And there was just a Conscious Capitalism Institute conference last weekend in the Boston area.
Yes, indeed. And that's where I visited with our friend Cindy Wigglesworth and saw Judy Neal as well.
Oh, okay. So you were there for that, too.
I was, yeah.
So what else do you want to say about conscious capitalism? How do you define it?
Well, yeah. How do I define it? I think that I define it basically in three ways, and my thinking on this has been very much influenced by the conscious capitalism group that gathered, that John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, invoked a few years ago. Initially, a bunch of people, I was invited, some academics, some writers, some CEOs. And as we talked about it, and this kind of was in my thinking as well, it's got a bunch of different components. And one of the terms that you mentioned early during our intro was the term stakeholder. That's a very, very important word in conscious capitalism, and I'm coming at it from the economic point of view first. In traditional capitalism, shareholders are more important, heretofore anyway, than stakeholders. Shareholders being the individuals who invest in a business. Their interests are considered very important, most important. But even traditional capitalists acknowledge that there are other stakeholders, such as employees, certainly customers, suppliers or vendors, the towns or cities in which your business exists, and ultimately the planet at large. And today, the one of the stakeholders we hear the most about is the environment or the earth. So in conscious capitalism, stakeholders are including shareholders, who are very important stakeholders, I wouldn't say their interests are completely equal, but they are roughly equal, and there is a profound sense that for an organization to succeed and thrive, all stakeholders must be honored. So that's kind of coming at it from the economic end. From the more spiritual or conscious end, what distinguishes conscious capitalism from traditional capitalism is that it has a higher purpose than simply making money. For me, the definition of unconscious capitalism is that making money, achieving profit, is is the reason for business. And most, I say most, that's, I don't want to believe that's true, but many, let's say many companies are run with that philosophy. What are we here to do? Oh, come on, we're here to make money. That's what we're here to do. Whereas conscious capitalism has the consciousness to desire a purpose above and beyond making money. Now, that said, conscious capitalists very much want to earn profit and very much want to make money, but they want to do it by fulfilling a higher purpose, by having a reason for being there, even if at the most mundane level, it is simply to make a customer happy. That at least is the purpose that's above and beyond making money. Related to that higher purpose is an equally spiritual component, which is the notion that values are play a critical role in a business model. That, and leaders fit right in there too, because leaders must embody and exemplify the values that the organization holds dear. And of course, the people in the organization, employee engagement is a huge buzzword today. And I think it is because employees are disengaged, because in many companies, sadly, leadership does not embody values. And so people can't be inspired, they can't be moved, they can't be motivated. And they're reflecting the very low level raison d'etre for the company, which is to make money. So if your company, if you create a business and that's its only reason, you can bet that you're going to attract to you people who their only reason for being there is to make money. And that's a sad situation. So conscious capitalism brings in a kind of economic democracy. It brings in a vision, it brings in a purpose, it brings in values, and it brings in a leadership that endeavors to embody those values. Mm-hmm.
So as you were sitting with your journal and starting to, in the early stages of this book, and you were writing down trends, you came up with seven what you called megatrends. And there, I've got a two-part question. The first thing on my mind is to ask you to first to tell us what those are, just to, so that we're all on the same page and we can know what they were. And then I'm kind of curious as to the thought process or the research process or what your process was in determining, oh, this is a trend, but it's something I'm observing, but maybe it doesn't quite fit what I'm calling a mega trend. What made them seem so powerful to you?
Well, actually, a point of clarification: the my list really were about trends, and then my insight was that these are trends. They may be very powerful trends, but they're not in and of themselves megatrends. However, they all together comprise a larger megatrend. That is conscious capitalism.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. So what were those? Just identify for us real quickly what those seven trends were.
The economic aspect of capitalism, the conscious capitalism itself in its more economic businessy component is certainly one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cheat now and look at my list here to do it in order so we can kind of, the most important one was that spirituality, instead of being, let's say a more individual pursuit, a pursuit that one undertakes in their private time through their religious services or their individual contemplation, was somehow that people were somehow wanting to experience that sort of meaning at work. Spirituality at work, the Association for Spirituality at Work, this notion that I don't just go to work to make money. I go to work to fulfill myself. I go to work to express myself. I go to work to be creative. I go to work to serve in a deeply spiritual or even religious way. So the kind of the refusal of spirituality and the people who espouse it to, you know, leave their values at the door of the workplace was the number one trend that was pushing this forward. And then, and that's kind of like a, there, if there are two maybe fundamental sides of the coin here that we're talking about. One is the spiritual side, and the other one, the other side of the coin is this movement that is already existed within business, which I'm now calling conscious capitalism, which, you know, earlier on might have been defined as corporate social responsibility or this notion that businesses needed to be responsible as well. That's the second trend, and that's the second fundamental side of the coin. From that, this notion of middle managers, I know a lot of people in the spirituality movement say, you've got to get the leaders. If you don't get the leaders involved, you can't change an organization. And, you know, I may be dead wrong, but I cannot abide that philosophy. I can't abide that philosophy because if that's true, what you're saying is that individuals have no power. And if I thought that were true, I'd just, you know, I don't know what I'd do. Walk into the sea with you know, loaded down with rocks or something. Because, you know, how can you believe in spirituality if you can't affirm the power of the individual to change their reality, if only by changing the way that they react to this, their circumstances? So for me, there is some corporate responsibility types and some activists have a way of looking at the world that is so devoid of spirituality and devoid of individual power, in which I believe strongly. So I believe that you, if you don't have authority in your job, well, at least you have moral authority, and you can influence your peers, and you can influence your department, the department in which you live. How do you do that? You do that by embodying your values, by living and breathing your values. So this notion of middle management, the power of middle management, leading from the middle, to me, that's very, very important. And then from that, spirituality in business itself, very, very important. That's like number four on my list. And that's the notion that, hey, you know, it's there. You don't have to bring spirituality to business, as we said, if, you know, 10 years, as many as a decade, as much as a decade ago. You don't have to bring spirituality to business. It's already there. It's there in the hearts of the people who are working there. And whether you're having a Bible study course at lunchtime or a meditation group at lunchtime, individuals are living their spiritual life in the workplace. And that's, you know, my goal for that chapter. There, somebody told me, you know, there are different, you know, I've been writing like for 30, probably more, yeah, more like 35 years. And somebody said to me, you know, there are different types of chapters. There's there have to be kind of intellectual, philosophical chapters. And then there are chapters where you just throw at them everything but the book. You throw the book at them. And I was like, that's what I want to do in my spirituality and business chapter. It's not a philosophical chapter. I'm just going to give you every fabulous example that I can find. And by the end of that chapter, you won't be able to say there's no such thing as spirituality in business, because I'll convince you by giving you lots of examples. So that was my fourth one. And then to me, one of the most, well, that was the fourth one. Now the fifth one is also, I wouldn't call it a spiritual, it's kind of more of an economic trend, but it's a spiritual trend because it is about the power of the individual, and that's the values driven consumer. That's the whole notion that we have enormous power as consumers. 70% of the U.S. GDP is comprised of consumer spending. So if you think that it's the CEOs who rule the world, you're forgetting about the power of your investment, your dollars as a consumer. You and I are the ones who make or break a brand. More and more so as people become more sophisticated and companies need to know what we want if they're going to be successful. So the values-driven consumer and their desire the most obvious example is this: the green consumer, the desire to buy products that are based on health and sustainability. sustainability and all of the good things in life instead of, well, junk. You know, we want our products to be free of chemicals. We want them to honor the environment, and all of the rest. So that's the importance of the values-driven consumer and corporations that understand that trend and that learn to satisfy that consumer will be more and more successful. And the sixth one is one of my favorites, which is about how spiritual practice, and this is one of my favorites and also kind of one of the more controversial ones, which is that that business is importing various aspects of spiritual practice into business because of that paragraph that you read from Tom, because that only in a state that is an altered state of reality in which we are connected to source and to divinity, only then, that's where we're going to find the solutions to problems as mundane as a business solution to as profound as how to change the world or preserve the environment. Mm-hmm. So in these altered mental states with the invoking the alpha and the theta and the delta brain waves, this is where true creativity and innovation exists. And so no wonder all of the high-tech companies are the ones who are the innovators when it comes to bringing meditation into corporations. Mm-hmm. So it's controversial because I can't tell you how many people say to me, and these are usually not from the spiritual side, but more from the social responsibility side, more from the side of people who tend to be very critical of business, and as well as should be in a lot of cases, say, no, oh my God, that's the worst thing. Now corporations will manipulate us through, you know, meditation and religion, and it's just going to get horrible, you know. And I said, you know, it's kind of hard to manipulate God. Not that I haven't tried for 50 years, but it's kind of hard. So I don't think that's going to happen. I can't maybe persuade you that that's the case, but I don't think that's going to happen because I don't think it's in the power of any corporation to do that. I think that when you open a door to spirituality, positive things happen no matter what. And then finally, the last one is an established trend. Was a very established trend already in 2005. And that's the whole notion of socially responsible investing. That's the notion of, you know, you've got power as a consumer to vote with your pocketbook, and you've got power as an investor to decide that you are going to invest in companies or individual companies or in mutual funds or in bonds or now in ETFs, that make a contribution to the world, that contribute to society,
yeah,
and not ones that supposedly make you money.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a great summary of those ideas. And there's a comment I'm going to just throw into this mix a little bit. But before I do that, I just want to let everyone know that we're going to start moving into the portion of the call where I'm going to open it up and allow those of you who have questions that you'd like to ask Patricia to do so. So if you have a question, you can essentially raise your hand. I'm looking at a computer screen here, and I can see who's available and who's wanting to ask a question. You can raise your hand by hitting *5 on your phone. That'll raise.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it'll raise your little hand icon on my computer screen, and I can call on you by unmuting you. So if you have a question, go ahead and do that now, and you'll all queue up, and then I'll call on you as I can. And while you're doing that, I was reflecting on this book yesterday evening as I was thinking about our call, and there's two things that I really, really like about the book. There's a lot of things I really like about the book, but one of the things is kind of an overall theme as I was looking at it, and that's this. The book does a wonderful job of laying out all of these different ideas. You know, spirituality in the workplace and values-driven consumer and social responsible investing. There, you can kind of look at them as being kind of the things that are impinging on the organization from the outside, you know, consumers wanting to have a different relationship with the products they buy and the companies they do business with and the places they invest their money. You can look at it from the standpoint of the rising awareness and spirituality playing such a major part in individuals' lives, and so they want to bring that to work with them instead of leaving it at the door. And then also just from a pure economic standpoint of you talk a lot, and this was one of the things that I found really interesting, is that as I was reading it, I had to keep reminding myself, because you were writing this book at the tail end of the dot-com meltdown, and I had to keep reminding myself that this book wasn't published this year and not in 05. Because if you change some of the names and you change dot-com bubble to housing bubble, it's very, very current. And so it does a good job of pulling in, I think, the way just economic forces are impacting organizations today and forcing them to take a harder look at what it is they do and getting to that idea of true purpose beyond just making money. And there's this beautiful dance here that I found my mind just bouncing around from one idea to the other as I was reading this, and just seeing how they all played a role in working together to create this thing we're calling, for, you know, maybe for lack of a better word right now, conscious capitalism. You know, who knows, that term might evolve as the years go on. So I just want to applaud you for that. But that does lead me into this idea. Do you think we're making progress? Are
we? I know we're making. I know we are.
So as you sit here today,
the fact that it may not look that way,
yeah,
is one of the strongest indications that we are making progress, in the sense that everything that is all of the reasons why capitalism needs to transform have never been more in our face. Yeah. I mean, if you had any hope that traditional capitalism could continue to lead you, unfettered capitalism could continue to lead you to great economic prosperity, I mean, you just got to look at September 2008, when we, for I don't know how they did it, I don't know how Henry Paulson did it, but, you know, and maybe he did, maybe we didn't do it, and we're going to face more economic turmoil later, but somehow we were absolutely, unconscious capitalism had brought us to the brink of pure global economic destruction.
Yeah.
And everybody knows that.
So
I mean, they know that.
Yeah.
People know that. People know that in their hearts. It's just, it's imprinted. It's imprinted in people's hearts and minds that this cannot go on, that things have to change, that we have to, you know, that all of the spiritual growth that people have been going through, accelerated spiritual growth for decades, has to be grounded in our economic reality. That is to say, we need to transform capitalism through the power of our consciousness, or we will face another Great Depression.
So we've got a hand raised. I don't have a name, but the last four digits of the telephone number are 7683. 7683. It's a 201 area code. I think I just remuted.
Joe Meek is here.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Patricia, one of the things that I'm concerned with is, I guess, putting one ahead of the other. A lot of people want to put the capitalism or the economic as a priority.
And a lot of people want to put economic as a priority.
Yeah, as a priority.
Economics is a priority, yeah.
Yeah, the financial aspect. And yet they're still searching for the spirituality of it. And it's a question of which comes first. Well, do they come together? How do you mesh them? How do you integrate them?
I don't think you mix them. I think that you reach a state of consciousness in which they both exist and are not mutually exclusive within your mindset or your state of consciousness or your heart. because I am equally concerned about those who say, poverty is the answer. Don't, if you want to be spiritual, poverty is the answer. Don't tempt yourself with money. Money is the root of all evil. Well, I believe that it's the pursuit of money, the mindless, unconscious pursuit of money that's the root of all evil, and that spirit wants us to be prosperous, and if we can get over our fear of insufficiency, we can and will achieve the state of consciousness that allows us to allow them both to exist and not be mutually exclusive and not be in any way in conflict with one another. But, you know, humanity's got a little bit of evolving to do for that to happen.
Right. So what is the preparation in order to get people to be at that particular place?
It depends where they're coming from. Is there a particular group that you see as that you're working with, or that you see as you'd like to see have this kind of a change?
Yes, some of the people that I have been in contact with, they are business-oriented. And they fall back wanting the spirituality, but they want to also see, they're also results-oriented. So they want to see what's the outcome of this? Is it going to work? Is it really going to work for me?
Is it going to work for me? In what terms would it have to work for these people to satisfy them?
If I were to place myself in this position, is it basically guaranteed that I will be able to put this together and it will make me a better person totally?
The real fear is that if you choose to be a better person, that you will somehow suffer financially or economically. And I think that the reverse is true. That and that said, I don't believe that spirit or God asks you to be poor or miserable or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it's a change in mindset in which we begin to see our spirituality as a place of wanting the best for oneself as well as for others, or for others, and including oneself in the circle of those to whom you might want to serve or you might want to wish well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your question. Yeah. I mean, he does push into this idea that by and large, the majority of people in business are used to dealing in a world that is focused on results.
That's right.
And so when we, if we, and I say we, and there's a lot of folks on this call that are probably in their consultants of one type or another, or they're working with businesses, and if we want to get through to those folks, we have to be able to speak where they're able to hear us. And that means that there's a passage in your book, and it's some wisdom you gained from interviewing a woman. I don't remember her name, but as I recall, she was offering meditation and yoga practice in businesses.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And she talks, and do you remember what she talked about? There were three points that she made.
That's in chapter 6.
Do you remember what they are?
I think I can find it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she talks about, 3 points. Sell the benefit, know your customer, and use sales as a spiritual discipline.
Yeah.
And that is on page 132. And that's Tevis Trower. She's since married, and I cannot recall her married name, but in any event, she has a wellness group that teaches yoga and meditation to all sorts of large companies in New York. And she talks about she was so amazing. I mean, it was like, what an amazing combination of just what this gentleman is talking about, the spiritual and the practical at the same time. But we can come back to that if you wish. But in terms of results, well, look at chapter 2, and I have a wonderful update to chapter 2 about how companies that how conscious capitalist companies outperform the competition enormously in terms of pure financial success.
Right. Say more about that. Have you got some more recent information to add to that?
Yes, I do. There are various studies in Chapter 2 about companies, and there are, you know, 1-year studies, 7-year studies, 15-year studies. Well, since then, a wonderful book by colleagues of mine in the conscious capital movement, a book called Firms of Endearment. It's kind of a play on terms of endearment.
We talked to Raj Sisodia.
Talked to Raj. Okay, so
a couple of months
Raj,
ago, so, yeah.
Raj nailed the research,
yeah.
which was they studied a group of companies, if memory serves, 28 companies that over the course of a 10 or 15 year period, companies that were run in terms not of just managing for profit, but for managing for stakeholder value in general, their stock rose 1,000% compared to 100% for the S&P 500. So they outperformed the S&P 500 being a benchmark of the 500 largest companies that, you know, usually in investment terms you look at, all right, so how did you do compared to the S&P 500? Well, they outperformed it by 10 or 11%. So, and there are, the Fortune, you know, there's a wonderful, in January, Fortune comes out with the 100 best companies to work for. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but similarly, the public companies on the 100 best companies to work for list, there are a lot of private companies, but of course they can't compare those, outperform the S&P 500 by 100%, or an enormous percent. And of these vary, of course, if you're looking at a 5-year period or a 10-year period or whatever. But the evidence is out there that companies that manage for more than just making money through what John Mackey calls the paradox of profit are much more successful than those little ones with the, you know, green eye shades who are just kind of like nailing you, you know, dollar for dollar. It doesn't create it. You can't create. A business is an enterprise. An enterprise has a soul. And if you don't feed that soul with consciousness and with human values, you just don't have a great business.
But, you know, this question, though, is a good one, that because it does push into something else that I think is I'm seeing and hearing over and over again about this idea. And it's that this idea of conscious capitalism is, and all that it brings in and all that that it entails and implies, is not something that an organization can just kind of take on as the flavor of the month and say, oh, that's the new way to sell more of our stuff. Let's call ourselves conscious capitalists.
Well, obviously you can't do that.
Yeah.
And don't think that people won't, because they will.
They will.
A few will.
Right.
A few will. But that said, there are now so many companies that truly are, well, even back in around 1990, when Amy Dominey, who founded the first socially responsible index fund, Dominey Social Investments, she created this company. And so she looked at, and this is 1990, 20 odd years ago, she created these so-called screens. That's what socially responsible investing is built on, screens that evaluate the social responsibility of companies. And she put the whole S&P 500 through her screens. 250 of them passed. The other 250 was forget about it. But back then, half of the S&P 500 was running their business in ways that stood up to her screens.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really not coming from 0%. I mean, I think that when we look at what's happened on Wall Street during the subprime debacle, we see the worst excesses of unconscious capitalism. But Wall Street and Main Street business are two very different phenomena.
Right.
And that we're not coming from zero. We're coming from, I don't know, 50%. And now, you know, we're up to, I don't know, 65%, something like that. So that conscious capitalism really has been evolving under the radar screen for decades and decades, you know, since the end of World War II, when, you know, modern business has its roots, sort of.
I like the, and again, just invite anyone, if you've got a question, *5, and we'll raise your hand and I can call on you. We've got a few minutes left here, time for one or two more probably. There was a, this question from this caller just takes my mind in so many different directions from your book. There was an idea that I made a note of as I was going through this, and it's this idea of moving from greed to enlightened self-interest.
Yeah.
Talk about
that was a good day when that idea came.
you can pass yourself.
Because it was a bridge. It was a bridge. It was like, you know, we're dealing with so much separation. The way our mind works is to encourage separation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just like struggling with, you know, how do I break? Because, you know, greed means not that you want to have money or abundance. Greed means no matter how much you have, you're never happy. Mm-hmm. That's what greed really is. It's a disorder. And when people say capitalism is based on greed, oh my God, it gets me so annoyed, because it's not true. We see again and again that greed destroys capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was like, how can I convey this? And so what breaks us out of greed, what breaks out of the concept of greed, and and what breaks us out of this notion that greed is always going to be with us, is no, there's something else. There's enlightened self-interest. There's the ability to see that your self-interest won't be served if you are stuck in antiquated, destructive notions. So that and the subprime debacle was a magnificent monument to the power of enlightened self-interest. Why even those people on Wall Street lost all their money through this system becoming so distorted, the system of capitalism becoming so distorted, and the institutions that believed in unfettered capitalism growing so distorted that the institution collapsed upon itself and no one's self-interest, precisely no one's self-interest was served.
Well, it seems to me in some respects the two ideas there, greed is based on the belief in lack and in winners and losers, and so therefore you want to be on the side of winning. Enlightened self-interest seems to rest very firmly in the idea of abundance and the idea that as I help raise the ocean and create more and more abundance, then all of the stakeholders in my organization are benefited and lifted up as well.
Well said.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's a powerful theme that works through this book, is that idea.
Yeah. And it's a powerful way to break us out of old thinking. Old antiquated thinking. And that is why this notion of calling it conscious capitalism is so important, because consciousness implies awareness. Mm-hmm. It implies, in fact, it implies a higher level of awareness that permits us to see more clearly what our self-interest is. Greed and self-interest are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Greed is self-interest run amok and never satisfied. I personally do not believe that self-interest is a horrible thing. I think that enlightened self-interest is a heck of a lot better thing. But, you know, if you don't have some kind of modicum of self-interest, I don't know how you can function and contribute and serve the world. I mean, you have to have food, shelter, clothing. You have to have, even more important to me, silence and peace. I'm not embarrassed to say that I harbor self-interest, not in the slightest. I don't know how I could be of any use to anyone if I didn't.
There's a quote on page 29 of the book that I underline, and it's very short sentence. It says, capitalism mirrors the awareness of its members.
Yeah.
And I just, that again speaks to this idea that we are creating structures, organizations from the place of our awareness. And at the same time, I think it also bows to the idea that our awareness is being opened up or changed by the structures that we're working within as well. So it's not an either or thing. You were talking a moment ago again about the idea of leading from the middle, and that it's not necessarily all about let's get the leaders of organizations enlightened and then wait for the trickle down effect for them to affect their organization. It's happening from every direction at once.
Yep, exactly so.
Yeah.
Exactly so. And you know, when the followers of capitalism change, when we grow more conscious, when we seek justice and freedom and economic democracy, we bring those beliefs and those values into our practice of capitalism by choosing to buy organic products, to choosing to buy fair trade products that aren't the cheapest thing around, but that serve and support people in developing countries. So our spending habits change, our investing habits change, and we bring all of these changes of heart and of consciousness and of mindset into the capitalist marketplace. And the old doesn't. I don't for a minute deny that the old power structures don't want to change. And the subprime crisis was a great example of that. They're going about their destructive ways, but they can't. But that the subprime crisis shows us that the old structures are falling away. That they have to fall away.
Right.
Because it can't continue this way, or there will, or no one will have any economic abundance whatsoever.
Wow, great thought. Let me ask you to hold for just a minute, and I've got a couple of announcements that I want to share with everyone, and then I want to come back for some closing thoughts as we wrap
great.
Up this hour. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Some announcements. First, coming up in November, the dates are November 7th through the 9th. Go ahead and you need to mark that on your calendar now and plan to attend the International Conference on Faith and Spirit at Work that will be held in Fayetteville, Arkansas at the University of Arkansas. More immediate, though, June 15th is the deadline for two things associated with that conference. The first is, June 15th is the deadline for applications for the International Faith and Spirit at Work Awards. And also, June 15th is the deadline for papers to be submitted for review and presentation at the International Faith and Spirit Work Conference. You can find more information about that on the website. Coming up on June 21st, our next guest on this series will continue in some of the same kind of ideas we've been talking about. I'll be interviewing Michael Strong. Michael is the co-author of a book called Be the Solution: How Entrepreneurs and Conscious Capitalists Can Solve All the World's Problems. So if you want to find out how to solve all the world's problems, be sure and tune in on June 21st. Also, we've got a group today that's listening in being led by Mel Toomey at the University of Arkansas. There are two more chances to participate in that workshop, Integrating Change Certificate Workshop. They're coming out September 13th and 14th, and then another session November 14th and 15th. So again, more information on the website. If you found out about this teleconference from someone else passing the email along to you and you want to get on the list so you can find out about future happenings with the teleconference and other things going on at the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace, go to the website and sign up there, and you can be in the loop that way. Want to thank Dr. Judy Neal, the Executive Director of the Center, for helping to make all this possible and for supporting this program and the sponsorship. So I have another reading I want to do from the book to close us out. But any final thoughts from you, Patricia? What's really exciting you today with the work you're doing? What are you seeing out there that's really juicing you up?
Another phrase that uses the word consciousness, and or conscious or consciousness. I think that you know, back in my earlier Megatrends days, I talked about how we're shifting from an industrial to an information society, and today we are shifting from an information society into a new economic era in which human consciousness and human creativity are the source of wealth creation and new job creation, and that reinforces this need for us to connect with our higher consciousness to create economic well-being and abundance in our lives.
Wonderful. So well said. Well, let me just close with this reading, and this is from the last chapter in the book on page 179. And it strikes a kind of a hopeful note, I think, as well. It's a good way to send everybody off into the rest of their evenings and afternoons. It is said in spiritual circles, if you want to change the world, you must first change yourself. Well, most of you already have. You've learned to listen to the silence, hear the inner voice, speak from your heart, trust something greater than yourself. You've walked the path for years, a decade, or even longer. Maybe you're not the CEO, but you've got a track record and a platform, and you mean to use it. What marks you as a grassroots leader is the commitment that ignites the potent mixture of inner power and action. Stand in your truth and act on your values right here, right now, and touch the people around you. And with that, I just want to thank everyone for being on the call today. I'm going to unmute the lines and you can say goodbye as we sign off.
Press 1 to mute all and disallow unmute. Press 2 to mute all participants and enable unmute. Press 3 to unmute all participants.
This conference is unmuted. Callers may mute themselves by pressing star 1.
Or invitation to advance.
So goodbye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Patricia.
Thanks, Patricia.
Bye-bye.
I probably shouldn't have even signed on to the group. I just didn't have any clue whether or not I'd do something with it.